This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium. I am Nigella Hilgarth, the Executive Director, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the latest in the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science lecture series. Now, this evening, as many of you know, is a little bit different. We are hosting part of a National Science Foundation-funded program in collaboration with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute and science centers across America. And the goal of this program, which is entitled Live from the Poles, is to increase the public's knowledge of polar research and the importance of Earth's polar regions. And as a special part of the program this evening, we're going to have a live chat with a penguin researcher in Antarctica, which I think is going to be very exciting. And before we do that, I can hear somebody murmuring about what other kind of chat can you have as opposed to a live chat, but we can go into that later. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker who's going to be talking about his penguin research beforehand, and that is Dr. Jerry Kooiman. And Jerry has been a research scientist, research professor here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography since 1967. And he joined the Physiological Research Lab directed by Per Schollander. He holds his bachelor's from UCLA and his PhD from the University of Arizona. And he's led about 45 expeditions to Antarctica. That's an enormous number. Incredibly impressive. And his most recent project was in 2006, where he was involved in the aerial surveys of emperor penguin colonies in the Ross Sea. He has had so many awards and honors that I couldn't begin to really go into them tonight. I just want to mention one or two, and the one that impresses me the most is that he has a mountain named after him in Antarctica. I just think that's incredibly cool. Kooiman Peak was named after him in 1996. And in 2005, he was the first recipient of the Ken Norris Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society for Marine Mammalogy. And in March 2007 of this year, he was the recipient of an award from the Explorers Club for polar field science. He's published over 160 scientific articles, and he's also the author of a couple of books, many on seals. And I think most of you may know Dr. Kooiman as a penguin expert on the emperor penguin, but he's also a great expert on the physiology of mammals from that area, particularly seals. And I think really without further ado, because I'm dying to hear about his research, I would like Jerry to come and kick off the Live from the Poles evening with spotlights on Antarctic penguins. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kooiman.
Thank you, Nigella, for such a nice introduction. And I hope that what I have to say tonight will be a nice capstone to what has been a beautiful day. And I appreciate your all being here after such a wonderful day. You're probably a little on the tired side if you took full advantage of it. I'll be talking about my favorite subject. And so the title, Penguin Survival in a Changing World, is kind of penguin-centric, I guess, in the sense that when I talk about penguins, I really talk about emperor penguins. I don't talk too much about others, but today I'm going to make an exception, or tonight, and I will talk about Adélie penguins. But before I go on with that, I wanted to make one short comment that I'm not the most legitimate Antarctic explorer here today. I want to point out that Paul Ponganis and Kathy Ponganis, who are sitting right down here, just returned from the Antarctic, and Paul came back Saturday, so his timing is still a little off, so any questions that I refer to him, he may be a little slow in responding. Well, let's move on with this, see if I can get this thing working. And I do. And so it's at the Birch Aquarium, so we're in the right place. And here's the schedule, and I want you to be sort of aware of this. I've got about 20 to 25 minutes to do what a presentation I have before we get our phone call. And so I believe David will be calling on an Iridium phone, and if he's got his time straight, we'll see how all that works. But I've arranged this talk so I can stop almost anywhere. And after we've had the phone, so that when his call comes in, we'll stop, we'll have a conversation with David, and you can ask him some questions. There's a mic in the center there that's the preferable one, where if you can get up to it, if you're in the middle or it's awkward for you to reach it, there is a mobile phone that somebody will bring around, a mobile mic, rather. So that's how we'll work it, and I hope I can stay within the time constraints once I start talking about penguins and no telling what may happen here. And then if I stop in the middle and I'm not finished, then we're going to go on afterwards and we're going to finish. So we'll see. Okay, understanding of climate change. In preparation for this, I really did a lot of reading, more than I probably want to admit, or I thought I was going to. I said, you know, I've got to get around this or get my mind around climate change in some way. And so one thing is that I've decided is this is the best of times and the worst of times for climate modelers. And, you know, the reason for that is they're getting all of the money, but they're taking all of the heat. And what I mean by heat in this case is not global change or global warming. It's they put out a model, and you can bet there's going to be a lot of people that don't agree with it. And so they're then in the position of defending that. So I thought, well, I don't know. I've got to get a little short change on that. So I decided to go on the web, and I came to this thing, perfect. Climate change, a guide for the perplexed, which I can tell you is what I am. And then one of the first sentences that caught me when I started this was, Al Gore is not a scientist, he is a snake oil salesman. Well, three cheers for snake oil salesman. He just got the Nobel Prize today. Do you know that? And that sort of put me off a little, since Al Gore is one of my favorite politicians. He's not a scientist, he's a politician. And so I decided, well, so much for that. I think I'll stick with Mark Twain, and climate is what we expect, weather is what we get. And so that's where we're going on this talk. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to talk so much about climate in that sense. I'm going to tell a story. And it's about a singular event that occurred in 2001. And, of course, all stories have to have a mystery to make them, so they're catchy. And so there's going to be a mystery in this. And we may even give you the solution before we get done. But before I do that, I've got to tell you something about emperor penguin travel patterns to set the stage. And I'm assuming a lot in this talk. I'm assuming that you've all seen March of the Penguins, so you know all about penguins already, or emperors. But I'll fill you in on a couple of things that they missed. And it should work that way, okay? And so what I'll begin with is the travel patterns, and then I'll tell you about the mystery. And then I'll tell you about a recovery that has occurred, and if I have time, it'll be from 2002 up to the present time, and what a particular colony is doing. And then I'll, if I have more time, I'll give you some of my conclusions about all this. But by then, I think the phone may have rung, and I'll be saved by the bell. Okay. All right, here is a really nice illustration, thanks to David Enley. He sent this over for his presentation. And so I've incorporated it. And it's when you go to the Antarctic, at least the part of the Antarctic we go to in the Ross Sea, you make a flight from Christchurch, New Zealand, and it's 2,200 miles over cold ocean. And it gives you a sense of just how isolated the Antarctic is. And then we land at McMurdo Station, the largest station in the Antarctic. And it's a major hub as far as for aircraft is concerned. So once we get there, then what you'll see is we get McMurdo Station. The storyline is going to be mainly around Cape Crozier, but the phone call is going to come from Cape Royds, where that is where David Ainley is residing at the present time. So here's a nice white picture, and I'm going to point out a few features. This is the Ross Sea in the late winter, so it's still cold. The whole sea is frozen at this time, except for a few dark spots where there are what are called polynyas. Polynyas are open ocean areas surrounded by ice, and they're usually created by strong winds. Well, Cape Crozier, there we are at the very southern part of the open part of the Ross Sea, and then we have Beaufort Island. And what I'm naming off here are the various, there are six emperor penguin colonies in the Ross Sea, and I'm going to show where they are, but I'm not going to show all of them to you. This is Franklin Island. These three are relatively small colonies of anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand breeding pairs. Then there's Cape Washington and Coulman Island. These are the two largest colonies known. Both of them have colonies that are about the size of over 20 to 25,000 breeding pairs, so they're substantially larger than almost any other colonies. And I don't think I'm going to show you anything about them either. So this is Cape Roger, the most northern. To give you an idea of dimensions in this great white space, the range from Cape Crozier to Cape Roger is about the same distance as San Diego to San Francisco. The big difference is between Cape Crozier and Cape Roger, after you leave McMurdo Station, there's only about 50 people, so there you are. Well, here we are at some of the travels that I want to point out, and I'm going to be ecumenical about this. I'm also going to show you some about Adélie penguins as well. But what I want to point out is this is the foraging patterns during the breeding season for emperor penguins. They go about 100 kilometers offshore, and they're going back and forth, and they do that about 10 times, each bird of the pair, through the season. But keep note of Cape Crozier here. So the foraging pattern of Cape Crozier is to go out to the east into this area here. Emperors feed mainly on a fish called the Antarctic silverfish during this time. And then at molt, the emperors leave, and they go, essentially, the Ross Sea doesn't have ice in it at that time. This is in mid to late December, and it's an open water circumstance then. There's a major pack ice area over here, and the emperors go 1,200 kilometers approximately in a straight line. And what do they do that for? They do that to change clothes. And that's the situation. And so that's what we'll come around to. But note where they are. They're out in the eastern Ross Sea. And now we look at the Adélie penguins. And their foraging areas, this is Cape Crozier again. They have a large colony there. There's a colony at Cape Bird and Cape Royds. And this is the Royds area. They stay fairly local. At Inexpressible Island, the groups there are staying still fairly close, but they're all going to the east, and this is true of Edmondson Point. It's also true of Possession Islands, and that's what we have as far as the dailies. Their trips are only about 2 or 3 days, so hence they're shorter for that reason and shorter distances. Emperors go out from 1 to 3 weeks, and so that's the reason another reason why they're traveling so far. This is the Adélie after they molt. Now, Adélie penguins are different from other small penguins that most of them also molt in the pack ice. And so they probably go out to the same areas, it looks like it, from this track here. And so here we are at Cape Crozier, and the birds will be migrating out towards the eastern Ross Sea again. They're doing it later than the emperors. They leave in late February to March, whereas the emperors did this, as I said, in about mid to late December. They make their journey out there. I don't have time to go into the details of that. It's extremely interesting, but we're going to move on. And what I'm going to show you now is something I want you to really get an appreciation of this, and that is the date. This is the 4th of February, and it's the 4th of February in 2000. Now, this is a dedicated scientist you're looking at here, because that means for me to be out there and to be putting a satellite transmitter on this bird so I could find out where it went after it molted, that means I missed the last Christmas of the century and of the millennium. I also missed the birth of two of my grandchildren, so there you are. And none of them are speaking to me to this day. No, that's not true. My wife is sitting right here in rapt enjoyment of this lecture. Any case, I put a transmitter on this bird, and the idea was I wanted to know how long it took and where they went in returning to the colony. And there are about 100,000 emperor penguins out here at this time, so how did I know that it was going to go back here? And I figured that out, simple arithmetic. There's about 100,000 emperor penguins here that migrate out to this area to molt. And so I figured my odds are good that I would put on a bird that returned to one of the Ross Sea colonies. And it took 2.5 months to get over there, and it stayed back well into the ice pack the whole time it did that. And then it came in from here. Now, if we were talking about Cape Crozier and a bird from there, what I would speculate, here's Cape Crozier over here. I would speculate that this bird would have stayed south and then come in from here. And that's what I'm emphasizing for the story that I want to tell you. I just skipped the main slide, so let me get back to this. All right, this is Cape Crozier, and this was an aerial photo taken in 1990, and it's the before picture. And this is what was fairly typical of Cape Crozier for us for the first 60 years or almost 100 years that we've known of the existence of this colony. This is the first discovered colony. It was discovered in 1902. And the emperors usually are in one of these rifts here. They get a little protection. Now, all of this ground here is bare for a reason. It's not because it's so hot. This is taken early in the year. Well, this is December, but I can tell you it looks somewhat the same in September or October, and it's because there's a 10,000-foot mountain peak back here, and the catabatics are so strong coming off that mountain that it blows a lot of snow away, and this gives the emperor some protection by being in here. To give you scale, that dark line right there, that's the edge of the Ross Ice Shelf. That dark line represents a height of about 50 to 60 feet, so that gives you some scale. This is East Colony of Cape Crozier, and this is West Colony. These are the Adélie colonies that are there, and David Ainley will probably talk about those tonight. There's about 20,000 breeding pairs there. There's about 140,000 breeding pairs there. It's one of the largest Adélie colonies in the Antarctic. And so back to this colony, it's one of the smallest emperor colonies, but it's important for the historic reasons and for what we observe there. And so let's go on to the next slide here. And this is the singular event that occurred, and that is B-15, the largest iceberg that has ever been recorded, broke out of the Ross Ice Shelf. Just as a matter of circumstance, it broke out in March. I was right next to it in February working on penguins, and we looked at it and said, that ice really looks loose, like it might break loose, which it did. Any case, by this time, this is July, it had broken out of this area, and it's moving over in this area, but it's broken in half. Originally, it was about 200 miles long and 40 miles wide. It broke in half here, so essentially split it. So the iceberg is still the largest iceberg recorded, as far as I know, at 100 miles and 40 miles wide. And so Here you see the outlines of the iceberg, and it's shattering and going to pieces. And then what happens is something really unusual. And I do it in this panel, so I'll go through this. It'll be a little hard to see, but it's the B-15A, we called it, one section of it, drifted to the west. The normal trajectory for icebergs breaking out of the Ross Sea, out of the Ross Ice Shelf, is to go to the northwest and out of the Ross Sea fairly promptly over a several-month period. Well, at this time, we're looking at it in November 2000. We know from Grant Bartlett, another person on that project with David Ainley, counted the birds there. This is a year we didn't go down because I was busy over chasing penguins in the eastern Ross Sea. And we know that it was when the colony had been growing steadily, and it was near one of its maximum numbers. There were 1,200 chicks, so there's 1,200 breeding pairs of adult birds there. And they're coming and going, as I showed you from that track. They're going out and foraging here, so they probably knew that iceberg was in the area. Well, in the course of January, it moved in closer, and then by June, it's starting to slip into this embayment. And not only that, but C-16, which had broken out from the corner right here, had also moved into the area. And it's a substantial iceberg. So it had run into Cape Bird. B-15 was drifting down into the colony. By this time, the birds have come in here, probably got through coming from the east into here. They came in mid-April. And the females have laid the egg, and they're just about ready to leave for the next 2 to 2.5 months while the male incubates the egg. So then what happens, by July, B-15 had pivoted and rammed into Cape Crozier. And you can imagine what kind of a problem that might create. Well, I'm going to show you what kind of a problem it said. This is the underlines. B-15A is in the area of Cape Crozier, and then finally it pivots and goes into the embankment. Well, it stayed in there, moving back and forth, sort of back and forth like a battering ram almost. And this image taken in October shows that the birds from Beaufort Island colony could not get through from the east here. Their main foraging area is probably out here, so they had to go around. That's a 100-mile detour just up to get around the Cape. Franklin Island birds, same problem. They're going around, but it's not very far. And then by December, it's broken up. And the iceberg is still there, though, and forming a major barrier. And there's really no way for birds from Beaufort to come around this way. They have to go around the way. But by this time, the Crozier birds could come and go if they were there. Point is, they're not there. And here's what I'm going to show you has happened. This is the, what's that doing? Did I go backwards? Oh, I see. Good. I almost didn't recognize the photograph myself. This is what Cape Crozier looked at when we arrived in October of 2001. And we knew the iceberg had been in the air, looking at satellite images, and we were asking ourselves the question, had it created a problem for the birds, and that would be very interesting for us. And this, as you recall, is the way it looked with those rifts. Those rifts don't exist. All these are broken up bits of the Ross Ice Shelf. B-15 was up over here beyond the picture now, still in the area, but this was a shattered conglomerate of icebergs and ice rubble. And that's what we saw when we flew over and went into the area. And so now this developed into a paper called The Effects of Giant Icebergs on Two Emperor Penguin Colonies in the Ross Sea. And we're talking about just one of them now or tonight, and that's Cape Crozier. And David Ainley is on your left, and Grant Bartlett is on your right. They're two of the main authors of the paper, as well as Paul Ponganis, who, raise your hand, Paul, so people can see where you are anyway. Okay, so what we learned, and this is the mystery, what we found were no live birds. We first went in, it was Greg Marshall and I to hike down the hill. We'd come over to do this quick survey. Paul was back at Penguin Ranch carrying on with some physiological research there. And here's where the main group should have been. We never got to that on our visit. This was discovered by Grant Bartlett later. What we found was the scattered collection of birds. And I should say bird. There was usually one bird or at most over in here, two birds. Actually, there were three birds in this area. And these birds were dead. And we found four chicks and about 18 eggs. And so it had wreaked havoc in this area as far as what had happened there. What happened to all the other birds, the 2,500 adults that had come into the area and approximately the attempt, and presumably they got in there and they did lay eggs, because they could get in and out at that time. So presumably they laid somewhere around the neighborhood of 1,000 eggs. Well, this is the sort of thing we were faced, and this is what we went back a second time in November. Greg Marshall and Paul went down to the site where we'd been. We went to an outer site to search around in that, and that's where we found these. And this sort of thing we'd find is the odd dead bird here. And I think this ice axe was marking where we found a single egg in this particular circumstance. And so we're searching for evidence to try to determine what may have occurred. So this shows Paul with a couple of birds in his backpack. We were taking those back to McMurdo Station and to here at Scripps to do autopsies on them, try to determine what the cause of death was, which is pretty straightforward. before we even started, we wanted to get the details of it, and that was that the birds that we collected had starved to death. Well, all good mysteries have a side story or another story going on. So I'm going to show you a little bit of a side story. This is what a normal nesting, a daily penguin looks like. And you can see there's a small chick there. It's just this chick here is probably a few days old. And that's where a nest is. They're on land, and they've gathered a lot of rocks to build their little depression that forms their nest. Well, when Robert Van Dam and I went to the outer parts where those scattered groups were that I showed you, or scattered places where birds had been, what we had thought when we flew over the first time were emperor groups, turned out all that stain and everything from the guano, those were Adelie penguins. And here are the Adelies. And what's going on here? These Adelies are on ice. They're not on the land. This is ice rubble around these bergs. And what we also saw is a lot of birds stopped by these icebergs. They got up on top of them, and there were cliffs there, and they couldn't get off of them, and they were really perplexed about how they were going to get over to the main colony, which some of them eventually did. But as I said, we thought these were imps. They weren't. They were Adelie penguins. And so if you take a closer look at these birds on ice, if you look at that bird, it's got an egg under it. So they actually bred on the ice. They used little ice chips for stones to build their nest. And they built those around it. And then they had established a nest there. Well, this is my foot. And despite what it looks like I'm doing, I'm not standing on that bird's wing to hold it in place. This bird, when I walked by it, didn't behave right. Behaving right would have meant that it got off its nest, because I had to go fairly close because we were walking up through an ice ledge. And it didn't get up and run away. And I said, well, that's kind of funny, tame bird. And so I took another look at it. And what I'm doing is actually I'm chipping out here. The bird was sitting on two eggs in a pool of ice water that it had melted into, and its feet were frozen in. They couldn't get up. And so I knew that was going to happen. But it was one of those. So, I mean, we were really in a hurry. We were flown in by helicopter. We had 4 hours of ground time to try to gather as much evidence as we could. But I couldn't pass this up, so I chipped it out and got the bird out, and then I went on my way. Needless to say, and this shows the little ice chips where they're doing the rubble, and needless to say, those Adelies that were breeding out there and laying eggs were not successful. And but to come back to the results of the emperors now, the Adelie situation is another mystery, and maybe David can answer some of the questions about that. We couldn't stay around to get more of an idea what was going on with the Adelies. But as I say, we found 18 adults, 19 eggs, 4 dead chicks, and 0 live chicks, and that was it. But here's the mystery. And what we found in a place called G1, that was the original site of where some birds were found. Those birds that were dead in that site were all trapped. There had been a major uplifting of the ice, and the birds were caught in that uplifting, and they were still standing in place and frozen there. But of those, 6 of those 7 birds were all males. And that's what we expected of all these birds here. What our original scenario was is that the birds were there, the females had gone, birds that stayed were the males, and they got trapped in there when the ice started crunching and grinding. Now, I don't know if any of you have been around big ice when it starts running into each other, if you've been in the Arctic or in Greenland or somewhere. But when big ice starts running into itself, it makes a horrendous noise. It sounds like a locomotive going off. And I can tell you, these birds, except for the sound of the wind, when they breed and nest, this is a very quiet, calm area. So I can't imagine what kind of chaotic feelings these birds had about all this noise and disruption that was going on and what it may have done. But the interesting thing was, at those scattered areas, all of those birds were females. And so that kind of perplexed me. It's taken me about 5 years to figure this out. But anyway, what I think happened was that the ones on the outer edge, there was actually an exchange that went on. Some of the females, in fact, quite a few females must have come back to even find these, came back and switched with the males. The males left and never came back. And the females hung on. And the ones we found were the few that stayed until they starved to death. The others may have exchanged or stayed around for a while, probably left. And so there was probably quite a few birds in the area at one time in around mid-August. And this is kind of a very small number of the result. Well, that's my story. Dedication of both the males, the hang-on. It's remarkable that even four chicks were hatched, and I suspect there were more than that hatched. We just couldn't find them because they were probably buried under ice. This is just to review that area, and so G1 was back here, and then the areas where we found the dead females was in here and scattered out on these areas of this sort. So somehow those males managed to walk with the egg and get out of the original area and get out to a place where the females could get to them and swap. Or it was the other way around. Females swapped with them and then managed to get out. But in any case, it was something of that sort. Now, what I'm going to, David hasn't called yet, so I'll carry on until we hear. But that's the main story. That's the mystery. But what I'm going to give you now is kind of a long epilogue. And the epilogue is as far as what's happened since then, and we were lucky enough to be able to pursue this. B-15 stayed in the area through 2002 and has moved off a little, so it gave a little room. But if there wasn't enough problems for the Empress as it was, in May, another large iceberg, as big as B-15, that was about 100 miles long, broke away from the Ross Ice Shelf right in the same area. It's C-19, and it's hardly talked about it. You've hardly heard about it, probably. But it, too, was forming a barrier here in August for any kind of travel for birds from Crozier out into this area or back from that. And again, Beaufort Island is sitting here with this main barrier still here and not going anywhere. This remained, but C-19 followed the normal trajectory that icebergs coming off the Rice Shelf do, and so it disappeared fairly promptly and drifted out of the Ross Sea in a northwest pattern. Well, when we went back in 2002, we weren't even sure it was worth going back, so what I did was I made a flight down there on an aerial reconnaissance mission that they were doing other things, and I went along to get some photos. So I took this photo from the C-17 in August. It's called the early winter or late winter flight, and these are patches that I took, and there were actually five groups. So it's still an unusual pattern. They're not grouped all together. They were scattered, but there were scattered groups of five groups. I show two of them here. The other one is over here, and one's down in this area. Then in October, just to give you an illustration, I got a satellite image, and this is from Digital Globe, and it shows this dark patch here and a dark patch here. That's these two right here. But G4 is missing, and what we learned when we got there is there are still kinds of problems that they're having, because G4, these birds had established themselves in a narrow canyon in very active ice. It's a bad idea. And when we got there, that canyon had disappeared, so I presume that the ice had closed there. And whether the birds got out of there or not, I'm not sure, but that was the situation in 2002, so it was, again, kind of a downer year. But this is what the colony looked like in 2000. So they came back, and they actually produced 247 chicks. So it's a big drop from what they were doing, and I think that drop is a result of both the missing adults. I think there are a lot of adults that died in 2001, but there's a tenacity to breed. And in this case, it's very unusual. They're not in the rift where they're protected. They're sitting on top of this iceberg, very exposed, and actually producing chicks that looked in half-decent shape. So then we went into 2003, B-15 is still hanging around, and to make it, a long story a little shorter, it it started to break up. There was a break across B-15 in October, and there's clear separation, and then by December, B-15A is drifting north, and I think this was called B-15J, and it stayed in the area spinning around. But you notice one other thing is that there's a lot of open water here by December, and that had been a pattern that the ice had been breaking up as far as the sea ice is concerned, but Beaufort is still in a very difficult position as far as getting around this iceberg to get any foraging areas or come into the area. Okay, then I'll go on. And this, I'm sorry to say, I could not get out onto the iceberg to count these birds. We got an aerial photo, so we counted the adults. It was so isolated that, remember, I said these walls were about 50 to 60 feet high, and there was a gap, enough of a gap between them that we couldn't climb out like we had done the year before. And believe we tried for 3 days and searching in different places, and it was just too risky. It never worked out. I didn't feel like ending up like in one of those crevasses that was created by them. So we gave up and just took that number, and then we came back in 2004, and it's been steadily improving over these years. B-15 keeps hanging around, but there's a big gap here where the birds can come into the colonies, and then they can depart and forage. Beaufort is still hanging out here with this long trip to get around, still can't get through here. But the emperors at Cape Crozier this year jumped up to 475 chicks. So have substantial increase in a number of breeding pairs and their success. And this is... I wanted you to note this extensive ice plate. This is in December now when all the ice should be breaking up. But B-15 had formed a barrier here and C-16 as well so that this ice was protected and it wasn't going out. So it created problems, and I think it created problems both for the Adelies at Cape Bird and Cape Royds, but as well as Beaufort Island. They had a long walk to get the open water to forage. And that created, a number of problems for the birds as well. Then something really strange happened in 2005. Greg Marshall and I went back to Cape Crozier with the idea that this had all opened up now so that birds could come and go, and so it should be pretty good. It looked fairly normal when we flew over and we saw the birds down there and said, oh, great, it looks like they're breeding again and it's more of a normal situation. But very close to the ice, as there was no protection. And anyway, and they were down on the sea ice now, not off an iceberg. Well, I don't think this has ever been recorded before. There were no chicks, and there were no eggs. There were about 147 adults right nearby in a cluster, and then another 126 over towards the ice edge. There was no sign of any breeding at all, and I don't think that that's ever been recorded in an emperor colony of birds coming into the area and not breeding. And so that's the second mystery, and I don't think we'll ever have an answer for that one. It's a unique observation. So this photo simply shows that amount of sea ice, and this is at the end of December or January, and so that ice isn't going to go away. If it's that late and it's still there, it's there to stay. So I reckon that, that's the phone call. We got to stop here. So I'll leave you hanging and thinking about all that ice there and what the birds, the Adelie penguins, are doing at Cape Royds with that long a walk. It's about 50 or 60 miles to get to the ice edge. And their cycles are short, so that means they've got to come and go every 2 or 3 days. I mean, it takes them that long to get to the ice edge, and they're supposed to be turning around and coming back. So think about that, you know. Well, I talked to David. Is he here? Hello, David. Are you there?
I'm here. I can barely hear you.
Oh, I can hear you fine, so I'll try to talk a little louder. And how's the weather down there?
Last 2 days, it's been the best of the season so far. Up until 2 days ago, it's been very windy.
We've got a number of questions for you, David, and so are you ready to get a few questions?
I guess I'm ready as I'll ever be.
Okay, does anybody have a question?
I wanted to ask you what was happening to the food supply for the Adélie penguins. Has that changed a lot in the last few years?
Well, the food supply has been just fine. The penguins are competing with minke whales for crystal krill or ice krill and Antarctic silverfish.
Does there seem to be any shortage of it, David, or are the chicks getting pretty robust?
Chicks. Last year we had one of the best seasons in the past several. The big icebergs had gone, and except for when minke whales are here in abundance, the penguins have a pretty easy time of finding food. But when the minke whales are, and also the type C fish-eating killer whales, when they're around, the penguins have to make longer foraging trips and also dive a little bit deeper.
We've been hearing a lot about how the breaking off of the icebergs affected the emperor penguins. How did that affect the Adélie penguins?
Well, that's a very complex sort of thing. For Cape Crozier, which you probably heard about, the emperor penguins at Crozier, the big iceberg occupied most of the foraging area of the Cape Crozier Adélie penguins. And without those icebergs, which were huge, that part of the Ross Sea is usually the marginal ice zone of the Rossi Polynia. And in that ice that rings the Polynia, there is usually a lot of food for Adélie penguins. But with the icebergs present, the Cape Crozier Adélie penguins had to forage out into the center of the Rossi Polynia, which, even though it's really productive, there's not much of a food web there because not much other than pteropods eats the Theocystis that grows in that part of the Ross Sea. On the other side of B-15, on the western side, the icebergs prevented the flushing of sea ice out of that part of the Ross Sea, and so the sea ice was was impenetrable. It was almost a continuous sheet of fast ice. So the Adélie penguins on that side of the iceberg had to walk a long way to get to open water, and they just gave up. They didn't want to make the trip too many times. So initially there was a lot of eggs lost, and then after that, any eggs that hatch, the chicks starve. And that went on for about 5 years. But so now that's no longer happening.
Dave, does that mean there's been quite a reduction in recruitment, or not recruitment, but chick production at Cape Crozier over the last several years?
At Cape Crozier, no. There was just the chicks fledged at a lighter weight than they normally do. There was a major reduction in chick production at Cape Royds and Cape Bird. And in fact, at Cape Royds, we haven't really had much in the way of production for 5 years. And so this season, for instance, we don't have any young penguins that are breeding. The youngest penguins are around 7 years old, just kind of unusual. Usually you have a lot of 3- and 4- and 5-year-olds. So that restriction of nesting success for those 5 years has affected the Cape Royds and, to some extent, the Cape Bird colonies.
The question is, with regard to all of this travel and climate change environmental change for these birds. Do you notice anything along the lines of the beak of the finch type of thing that might be visible among the surviving birds, which might have come from these hardships that they're enduring, like longer legs for the longer trips or something like that?
No, we haven't noticed that certain birds were favored over others. We haven't really measured that. So, good question. Could seem that the birds that were successful were ones that knew that they could find food by being Weddell seals, by diving into the water through tide cracks and also cracks out in the fast ice. So the birds who felt they had to walk all the way to the open water to get food, those are the ones that failed. So there's kind of like a behavioral selection, I guess.
The question is why B-15 remained so long in the area and didn't follow the trajectory that normally occurs to the northwest.
Well, B-15 got caught on a pinnacle that's part of Beaufort Island, which is north of Ross Island, is a volcanic island, and actually it's one part of the rim of this caldera, most of which is under sea. So B-15 got caught on a pinnacle of this, on the edge of this caldera, and it stayed there until there was a tsunami that floated it off, and then it floated free and continued its journey northward.
Say, David, one thing we were wondering about, are you camping at Cape Royds, which we have on the screen here at the present time, or are you staying in a hut there?
We're staying in it's called a rack tent. It's a tent with a floor and a door.
That's called a rack, did you say?
Well, the manufacturer calls it a rack tent, R-A-C-T-E-N-T, and I have no idea why.
Yeah, that sounds new. How do you like it?
Yeah, it's similar to the Polar Haven tents that you're used to using. We did have a Polar Haven with your autograph on it. It blew away a few years ago.
You threw our autograph away?
Yeah, blew away your autograph. And so they replaced it with this rack tent, which is pretty similar to the Polar Haven, except it's got wooden ribs instead of metal ribs.
I was curious about the patterns we're seeing tonight, and if there's a purported connection to global warming. It seems like we haven't really explicitly said if that's an unusual pattern that might be in this decade or not. Can you comment on that?
Are you asking if global warming is affecting penguins here?
If it's affecting the breakup of the Ross Ice Shelf, the size of the icebergs, and the way they're impacting the migrations of the penguins, which I suppose would be specific to the last decade or 20 years.
I think Doug McKyle from the University of Chicago would answer that question. He's the one who's been studying B-15, and he has seismometers and cameras out on the Ross Ice Shelf, and I believe his answer to that is that, well, if we start to get more of these big icebergs, then the answer is yes, but I guess he's waiting to see what happens. These big icebergs have been forming for the last 12,000 years as the West Antarctic ice sheet has been receding. It used to cover the entire Ross Sea, but now it only covers about half. And, of course, the way it recedes is that it produces icebergs faster than the glacier can be renewed upstream. So if that process has changed. I guess folks are waiting to see more of these icebergs, or I guess if there's a rise in sea level, then the grounding line of the Ross Ice Shelf will retreat, and there'll be more of an ice shelf, and probably it'll be more unstable, and then in that case it would produce more icebergs. But I guess no one has yet found evidence, or I don't even know if anyone's looking, to see if indeed the grounding line of the Ross Ice Shelf is changing.
David, I was wondering if you've seen any change in predation rates on penguins by leopard seals?
Nope. Not really. Here at Cape Royds, there aren't enough penguins to actually keep a leopard seal interested. But of course, at Cape Crozier, which is two orders of magnitude larger than Cape Royds, there are a lot of penguins, and thus there are leopard seals there, as many as 9 working at any one time. We did see during the big iceberg years, because the icebergs formed a shelf of ice off the beach at Cape Crozier, the leopard seal predation was actually reduced, because the leopard seals were forced, usually they kind of line along the beach at Cape Crozier, but with this shelf of ice, they had to be out in deep water along the edge of the ice, and so being out there, leopard seals themselves would be eaten by killer whales. So the leopard seals decided they didn't like penguins during the iceberg years. So that's the only change we've seen, and it was only short-term sort of thing.
Okay, Dave, I think we're going to let you go free and get back to work, but thanks for calling in on such a timely way and taking me off the hook here as far as what I was telling them here. So appreciated your answers, and look forward to seeing you after the season is over. So give my best to everyone down there, and have a great time.
All right. Glad to help you out, and see you soon.
Well, I would say the bottom line of what I was going to say in my conclusions is this, from what I learned from following these birds, and I think Paul would agree with this, is that we were really impressed with the capabilities that have always been, ever since we started studying, of the capabilities of the emperor penguin. And so as far as climate change is concerned, or any other kind of environmental change is concerned, I think these animals are very capable of dealing with them. They have they may have large fluctuations in their populations from time to time, but they're living in one of the most difficult environments, probably the most difficult environment on the planet in terms of where animals actually live. You could say Mount Everest is more difficult, but nobody lives up there, you know. And they have a great capacity, and I think the idea of that is that this species, from a recent paper, suggests that it's about 4 million years old. And so it's been through a number of ice ages. And so it's seen this or survived through these cycles of the ice extending out, as David said, well beyond the Ross Sea. And so that there was almost the whole Antarctic continent was just one big ice cap. They've survived through that, and now they're surviving through a major warming period where it's receded. And if it continues to warm, I think that the emperors will essentially follow the ice and move south with that ice and show amazing capabilities for coping with the kinds of environmental changes that would occur if they have to go further south. And so thank you for your attention, and I'll answer questions if you want me to try.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.